pick to see if I can be heard. If I'm going to say anything worthwhile, then it should be heard. Can you hear me now, or did you do the check, or am I done, or am I over? Do I have to keep talking? What do I got to do? Tell me. Talk a little bit louder. You mean I got to shout so that everybody can hear me? No, I'm not doing that.
The Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the Church and the world and just love. Just do it. Just love God, just love your neighbor, and just love yourself. And then our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. You know, when Pope Francis visited the United States back in September, you remember that, Angie, that he visited the United States? So were
Yes, were you awake for that? I was awake. Told me, I was in Texas, though.
You were in Texas.
But you told me about the Pope Mobile.
I told you about the Pope Mobile, and you were in Texas because you didn't want to see him because he was coming to New York, right?
That's exactly it. I left New York so I could avoid the Pope.
Okay, well, that's okay. But actually, today at New York, it's almost like Pope Day because the traffic outside and all the blockades is just horrendous out there. So when the Pope came, I think people were surprised by what he did when he addressed Congress. He highlighted, to make his points, four great Americans: Martin Luther King, Abraham Lincoln, Dorothy Day, and Thomas Merton. And he highlighted their conversations for their contribution to making society more just. I think probably almost everybody knew Martin Luther King Jr. and Abraham Lincoln. But I'm willing to bet that there were millions upon millions of Americans, and if the truth be told, Tom, even Catholics, who really didn't know much about Dorothy Day and Thomas Merton. And I'll even bet, if you know they do those political polls where they kind of do name recognition and stuff like that, I bet you even a lot of people didn't even recognize the names, not merely they didn't know a lot about them.
I agree with you, Monsieur. I mean, you know, I mean, I can tell you people even within my own family, I could say probably was like that too.
Right. So anyway, but he highlighted them as two Catholic figures who made a contribution not merely to the Church, but to American society. Our first guest, who we're going to speak with in a little while, is Daniel Ellsberg, who is somebody who has been an expert on Dorothy Day. He knew her in the last years of her life and was greatly influenced by his work. And then later on, we'll speak to an expert on Thomas Merton's life and work. So thanks for tuning in today and joining us on Just Love. Angie, you got any words of wisdom or insight for our listeners this week?
Ooh. I'm trying to think
all right,
something.
We'll give you a little bit of time. Tom, you got any words of wisdom?
Any words of wisdom? Oh my God.
Listeners, help me out. I mean, look at these two intelligent, alive, brilliant people. And I give them the opportunity to share their wisdom with the world. And what do? They hide it under a bushel basket. They don't let it shine so that others might see and give glory to God. They're keeping it all to themselves. They're hoarders of the wisdom that God has given them.
I know. Brush your hair before you go to bed so you don't wake up and it's all tangly.
Okay.
Is that?
Yeah. I mean, I would say, what I'd do is I'd keep you in the game. So, but you're not going to get a lot of extra credit for that answer. And what about me, who's got no hair?
That's a good point.
doesn't have any effect.
Well,
I was going to say that doesn't.
I'm out of ideas now. Now I'm out of ideas.
But you know, one of the things I do want to talk about, Tom, because I think it's very important since this is around Veterans Day,
yes,
the week that we kind of have celebrated Veterans Day. And I do think it's important from kind of our Catholic perspective to just talk a little bit about our perspective on war. And our own country, you know, suffered from one of those kind of great divides, ideological divides and political divides over a war which kind of was very much part of my growing up, the war in Vietnam. And that was that really changed a lot with regard to how we looked at war, and even more so the people who fought in war. I mean, they talk about this, and I don't think it's, you know, exaggerating. After World War II, before Angie was even thought about, there was a World War II, Angie, and a World War I.
Yep. I know all about
ancient
that.
History.
Yeah, you do.
Veterans Day from November 11th, 1918.
Oh, right. Okay.
It's the 11th day of the 11th month of the 11th hour.
You got it. And what happened on that day?
Ceasefire.
You got it. You
look
got,
at that.
There you go.
All right.
Now, that's a word of wisdom.
That is a word of wisdom. Hey, that is good. That is good.
Thank you.
So that is a good thing. So anyway, but you know, we kind of, as Catholics, have a very nuanced, I'll say that word, or complex, whatever word you want, kind of view of war. Because while there is a tradition within our church that recognizes pacifism, in other words, recognizes the fact that someone can, from a deeply held Catholic Christian perspective, can reach the conclusion that war is never a way that one should act to create a better world. And that's certainly a very, very firm part of our tradition. But it is not the only part of our tradition, and I think empirically, if you look at it, it certainly is not the majority part of our Catholic tradition. But what our Catholic tradition, which is very mainstream about in a certain sense, and why I say it's complex, is because we do believe that patriotism is a virtue, and we do believe that when one's country engages in, and I'm going to use a word, a just war, then the citizens are expected to participate in that and to share in the sacrifice of that just war. And so we have chaplains who support the troops in war. We encourage Catholics to do their patriotic duty. And so that's an important part of our tradition. And so our honor and our respect for the men and women who fight in wars is something that is very much part of our tradition. So that's one part of our tradition. Now, the word I used, Angie, did you pick up the word that I used? I said, those who fight in a just war, because part of our Catholic tradition, which is not a pacifist tradition, but it's a tradition which says, okay, there's so many problems in our world, and sometimes bad things go on, and sometimes bad things go on by nations and countries, that the only way to stop them is by going to war. But it's got to be just. You can't just go to war because some ruler says, I want to take over another country. You can't do it because somebody says, well, they have more resources than I do, and therefore I want to take over those resources. But on the other hand, what our tradition says is if there are times when a war can be justified. So in what the basic reasons where we say a war can be justified is if you've tried everything else, you know, and it's almost, we get this on an individual level because you kind of say, I dare you, I double dare you, I triple dare you. And, you know, and at some point you say, well, it's over. We can't go any further. Mm-hmm. Was trying to work this out. And so it's the same thing with countries. Now, the problem I have with this that part of the just war theory is the last thing. There's always somebody who says, well, you could try one other thing. But reasonably, you have to try everything you can without going to war. So that's part of it. Second part of that is, you know, and this is seems to be really empirical. It doesn't seem to be very theoretical and spiritual, but you got to say, hey, we got to have a chance of winning. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. We got to have a chance of winning because it's no sense doing all the damage, the killing, the death, even if the cause is just, if it's not going to resolve the thing. So that's another piece of the pie that we do. Another part of it is you have to not, you not have to do what we now call collateral damage intentionally. You can't take the innocent lives of civilians intentionally. Doesn't mean that at times in war there's going to be damage, but you can't do it intentionally. And that's why you go back to the first point is you got to make sure there's a just reason. You got to be doing it for right reasons. And it's got to be declared by the state. It's got to be declared by the people who have the authority to do it. And that's kind of a very interesting thing. That's become part of the debate in this country recently as to what is the War Authorization Act, mm-hmm. and when can the president engage troops without Congress? What's the deal on that? So what I'm saying is, as we're in this Veterans Day week, which Andrew reminded us is celebrated this week because in 1918, on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, that's when peace was declared at the end of World War I in Europe. So we honor the veterans on this day. But as Catholics, we got to balance this because we do say when there is a just war, we encourage people to do their patriotic duty. And we say that a nation has to be very careful about when it engages in war, that it can only do it a just war. And so what has happened to us, and this is my own opinion, but I'd be willing to debate this a little bit, is part of the problem what happens is when a number of people feel that it is an unjust war, and I can say this from my own kind of personally observing this, is that many people felt that the war in Vietnam was not a just war. And then what spills over is a little bit, you say, well, if the war is not just, if that's a perspective, and then the soldiers who are fighting in it, well, how do you view them? And the reality is they weren't viewed very favorably by many of those who thought it was an unjust war. And there was some really, really, and I mean, I saw it. There was some ugliness that is really things that were not good that was part of it. And there was ugliness on both sides. There was ugliness on the sincerity of those protesting the war was being challenged, and the ugly terms that sometimes were used about the soldiers who fought in that war. And so I do think, you know, 75 years later or 50 years later, there's a little bit more of a balance. And I think we understand a little bit better now that we can honor the work of veterans and not still be a people who kind of our first thing to say is we go to war, is we mm-hmm. can honor those who fight, but we also say that we have to do everything in our world to make sure that people don't fight. And so that's what we're doing you know, this week. It's we got to reflect on that. And it's not just because the president, the leader, the prime minister says we got to go to war. No. It's got to be some really looking at it from a really serious point of view as to what's going on there. And again, I think it's appropriate that we lead into that because one of the people we're going to be speaking about today is Dorothy Day, who, Tom, I think she was a pacifist, wasn't she?
She was, Monsieur, yes.
And an anarchist at times.
Yes, she was.
She was almost in everything.
Yes, at times.
You know what the great Republican senator from Illinois used to say?
Mm-mm.
Consistency is the haven of the feeble mind.
Now, I like that.
Now, he misquoted it because what it really said was feeble consistency. But why don't we go to our first guest? Because on all of these things, our first guest knows far more than I do about it and is far more interesting. Robert Ellsberg is the publisher at Orbis Books. He's written about an incredible number of wonderful topics. And so Robert Ellsberg, I'm sorry, Daniel Ellsberg, he did, my mind's on Vietnam because Daniel Ellsberg was the one who released the Pentagon Papers. So Robert Ellsberg, I'm sorry, Robert, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Okay, sorry I called you Daniel Ellsberg, but my mind was on Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers and all of those things. So
I'm not insulted.
Okay. Anyway, so thank you. And hey, how come the Pope mentioned Dorothy Day in his speech before Congress?
Well, I really wasn't surprised that he would mention Dorothy Day while he was in the United States. And Cardinal Dolan had certainly been, encouraging him to comment on her life, and I thought that would probably come up in the context of his visit to New York City. But I have to say I was surprised that he mentioned her and Thomas Merton, both in the context of his speech before Congress. Probably a lot of people in that audience immediately were scratching their heads about who these people were, and if they'd known more about them, might have been even more puzzled that he selected two Catholics who were such renegades in many ways, at least in their relation to the topics you've been discussing, war, social injustice, etc. Dorothy Day, who was arrested, repeatedly for protests in New York City and elsewhere about war. So I think that, but he was maybe speaking to a wider audience and holding up to American Catholics the idea that here are a couple of Catholics, and Dorothy Day, I think, certainly qualifies as somebody who kind of embodied his vision and his agenda for the Catholic Church. At least in an American context, if people wanted to say, well, what does Pope Francis really want of us? The idea that he would pick this person, Dorothy Day, who has been proposed for canonization, but who through most of her life was a fairly, marginal figure, and as you pointed out, still to a lot of people would not be a household name at all. And if they knew more about her, might even be very troubled and disturbed by her kind of radical brand of Catholicism.
Now, the other thing is that we also seem to have a penchant. I mean, it's maybe not exactly all the time, but we seem to like good girls turned bad girls turned good, bad boys turned good in both Merton and Dorothy Day, because Dorothy Day, probably in the first part of our life, it may not have made it into the cause for sainthood until there was kind of a conversion or a turnaround.
Well, that would probably be the definition of any saint.
they
undergone some kind of conversion in which their life mission kind of takes form radically around the challenge of the gospel. What led them to that, in the case of Dorothy Day, many years of kind of confusion. But she didn't abandon everything that happened before. She was in her youth a radical activist and journalist, and that kind of deep sense for social justice and commitment to the poor is something that she brought with her into the church, and then ultimately into the Catholic Worker, which she founded in 1933.
You know, Robert, one of the things that, I'm going to just confess to our listeners, and I hope they don't kind of throw me off the air for this, is I'm not a big fan of all the saints, okay? I'm not a big fan of all the saints. I think we got Jesus, and boy, I like Jesus. And so sometimes I don't get into all of the saints. But maybe what you could help our listeners to do, because I can't, is, given the uniqueness of the lives of the saints and the uniqueness particularly of Dorothy Day, what do? We take parts of it, we take values of the saints' lives, and we say, oh, that's a good part, and we don't think about the other parts. How do we use a person like Dorothy Day for, let me just say this, regular Christians, Catholics who are trying to live out their lives?
Well, that's a really good question. Obviously, all of the saints lived in a particular time, and they were responding to the context in which they lived, how they perceived the demands of the gospel for their time. And often those challenges are anachronistic, in our own time. They also were working with their own kind of human material. They were not, angels or Superman or woman or something. They were complicated people, and they had their own human flaws. And so, as you know, Dorothy Day liked to quote a spiritual director who said, "You could go to hell, you know, following, you know, imitating the sins of the saints." So I don't think we have to take any of them as you know, and we're not even challenged to be a saint like Saint Francis or Saint Benedict. As John the 23rd said, you know, himself in his diaries, he said, "I'm not called to be you know, another kind of saint. I'm called to be the saint that I'm called to be, the person that God wants me to be, my particular kind of saint." And saint, not a, you know, someone who's on a pedestal or performs miracles, but somebody who whose life is really focused on and organized around the Beatitudes, and tries to live that out in a very faithful way. And the number of actual saints is known to God, but it is much, much, much wider than the number of canonized saints. Those are just kind of paradigmatic, heroic examples that the Church holds up, not so we can honor them, but that they can serve as an inspiration and challenge to us to find our own particular way of being holy. So I can imagine a lot of people would look at various aspects of Dorothy Day's life and or her political positions or whatever, say, "Well, I don't necessarily share those." The challenge is not that we imitate, you know, her and all of her attitudes, but that we take as seriously in our own lives the gospel challenge as she did in hers in relation to the issues that she confronted, which are very much like the issues we confront today: inequality, unemployment, the search for some kind of meaning and community and work, peace, freedom, ecology, all those kinds of things. And she organized her life and built a movement to respond to those kinds of challenges.
You know, Robert, one of the areas that I've become more and more intrigued about is employment, you know, decent jobs, decent wages, as kind of a reflection of human dignity. Educate me, because I'm unaware of it. What was Dorothy Day's role in the issue of unemployment and fair wages and those issues?
Well, she responded to that in a couple of different levels. The Catholic Worker, as you know, was founded in 1933, was the heart of the Depression. Huge numbers of people were unemployed. She was, you know, concerned not only to respond to the needs of you know, people who were homeless or hungry by starting houses of hospitality and soup kitchens and that sort of thing, but she also was very critical of a social structure that treated people as if they were kind of disposable in that way. That put more concern in profits and in machines and you know, property than in the value of human beings and their labor. So she was a great supporter of the labor movement of that time. She was later a great supporter of Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers. Excuse me. She was in fact arrested with the farm workers in 1973, which she was 75 years old. But Peter Morin, with whom she founded the Catholic Worker, also believed that in kind of establishing an alternative economy or society that would, you know, based on the land and based on worker cooperatives and this sort of thing, where the emphasis would really be on affirming the dignity of labor and of the human being as a worker, as a co-creator and participant in God's creation.
So, without putting words in your mouth and without peeking behind the booth, but I'm going to, if you speculate, so she'd vote for Bernie Sanders this time?
No, Dorothy Day never voted in her life.
No, now that's intriguing. So
she was, it's interesting because she was arrested as a young woman for picketing in front of the White House on behalf of women's suffrage at a time when that was illegal. She was imprisoned in a kind of real Civil War era jail in Washington, D.C. or in Virginia, where she went on a hunger strike and was really brutally treated. So it's funny that her life, you know, began that way. She certainly believed in the right to vote, but she herself never voted. And
did she not vote because, having a prison record, that she was disenfranchised?
No. But just she was, she, you know, called herself an anarchist, as you,
right,
as you pointed out, and she just exercised her franchise, you might say, in a very different kind of activism, and didn't put much stress on electoral politics. So no, she never supported any particular candidate. So I think she would probably sit this one out as well, which is not necessarily, you know, we don't have to follow her example on that. But I guess that, you know, she would, rather than look at, you know, political parties.
What I've said all the time.
You could look at the kind of concerns that she has, and you could ask yourself, well, what kind of candidates or what kind of parties, you know, seem to reflect more of those values? And certainly, you know, her concern for, you know, hospitality toward immigrants, her concern about inequality, her concern about racism and social justice and these kinds of things that are more the kind of themes that were of and I think you know, she would certainly say there's no particular party or no particular candidate who completely embodies, you know, all of those concerns the way she did.
So if there were, I would say, give me two or three main themes that you would say of her life that today, as we're grappling with issues in our country, what would be the two or three that you think it's worth us reflecting on as a nation or as a church that we could learn something from her perspective?
Well, you know, again, I think we have in Pope Francis somebody who has, you know, very much taken up the kind of themes that were important to her. And particularly, I guess I would say, you know, that a society, and these are very biblical themes that go back to Jesus and the prophets, to look at the success or the power, the vitality of a country, not by its the prosperity of its richest or most powerful, you know, citizens, but by how it treats the least, and you know, by that, you know, standard, I think, you know, it will bring a very, very critical eye to our society and our economy. So, you know, Pope Francis's you know, idea that the church should step outside of its own kind of introversion to go out to the margins, and that our faith is really tested by how we see Christ in the disguise of those who are weakest and poorest and most vulnerable, and to criticize that kind of culture of indifference that makes it makes us you know, thick-skinned, indifferent to the cries, to the suffering of the poor. And what Pope Francis has done, which I think is, builds on also Dorothy's vision, is to call our attention to the connection between the way we treat the earth and the way we treat the poor, and the focus on kind of short-term self-interest and profits at the expense of undermining our sense of human community, but also our relationship to the planet on which we depend for life.
Robert Ellsberg, thank you so much for being with us. He is a publisher at Orbis Books and has enlightened us upon Dorothy Day and how she has something to tell our nation and to tell us as Catholics, as Christians, about kind of how we think about our world and the critical issues. Robert, thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for the contribution that you've made over the years to helping us to understand some of the somewhat complex topics. Thank you for being with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Great.
So much.
Okay. You know what? I think we'll take a break, and we'll talk when we come back about a few topics, and then a little later on in our show, we're going to speak about Thomas Merton with Paul Pearson, who is the director and archivist at the Merton Center at Bellarmine University in Louisville, Kentucky. Just love. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself. And when we do that, our world is more just and it is more compassionate. Join us when we come back in just 2 minutes on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church and the world. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. You know, Tom, when we talk about love and we talk about justice, there are three parts of that justice and love thing, which we kind of encompass in that word. When I say just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, because you got to get those three relationships right, because they're all part of what it means to be human. And so if one of those is out of order, things don't go too well. And that's so what you have to worry about is making sure that all three of those are aligned in the proper order. Someday we'll talk about, and Angie, what I want you to do for, you got more homework, okay?
Oh, I love all the homework you give me.
Okay. Listen, I gave you an apple crisp last week. If you do your homework,
gosh, the apple crisp was okay. So good.
Okay. If you're good, I'll bring you another apple crisp, okay?
What's my homework?
Well, okay, because we're going to talk about this, okay, in the future. I want you to read the first book of the Bible, the book of Genesis, okay, and figure out how those three relationships get messed up, okay? So when I talk about justice, we talk about just loving God, just loving neighbor, just loving yourself, okay? And the story of the first two books of the Bible is the story about the right order with God, with neighbor, and with self. Hmm. And then it gets messed up. Hmm. Okay? It gets messed up. And Angie, your job is to find the indications, the three examples of how it goes from a situation where things are really in good shape between God, with God, with ourselves, with neighbor, they're in good shape, then the fruit comes in, and then they're in bad shape. So I want you to find that in the first two books of the Bible.
Genesis? You said? Okay. Mm-hmm.
Genesis. That's okay. Okay, so you gotta find that. It's easy, but you gotta think. You don't think conceptually as much as think of images. So what are the events and the stories and what happens that shows that there was together, and then there was separation, okay?
Okay,
so
got it.
I'll give you an example.
Perfect.
Okay? So, if you and your boyfriend,
okay,
are in good shape, you're walking down the street holding hands, right?
Yes.
And then if you get in a fight, okay?
I punch him. Because he's wrong.
Well, obviously he's a man, so he's wrong. By definition. But then after the fight and you're not getting along, you kind of are each looking at your phones and you're texting somebody and you're ignoring each other going down the street. So that's what I mean. Like what I want you to look for in the first two books of the Bible is kind of those scenes in which there's a togetherness and things are in good order with God, with self, and with neighbor. And then after the fruit eating thing, there are things that happen that indicate that they're not together, that that things aren't going right. So that's your homework, and you get an apple crisp if you do your homework.
You get a reward for being by.
Tom, we got any news?
We do, Monsieur. You know, you mentioned before a little bit when you're talking to Robert about wages and how important wages are. Well, this week there was a lot of news about wages and minimum wage. Back on November 10th, as a matter of fact, there were demonstrations all around the country. They said there was over 1,000 demonstrations, large and small, that turned out on behalf of folks who wanted to turn out to increase the minimum wage to $15. They started out at dawn in front of many franchises of McDonald's in New York, Boston, Detroit, and many people were using the term "hold the burger, hold the fries, we want our wages supersized." They also had protest marches that went from the franchise.
Angie, you like that slogan? Do it again, Tom. What's the slogan?
The slogan was "hold the burger, hold the fries, we want our wages supersized."
What do you
think? Clever.
Okay.
I don't know. It's a little cheesy.
It's cheesy, you know. I mean, McDonald's supersized fries.
Was it cheeseburger? Is that what it was?
Okay. And actually, in New York State, we had some movement on minimum wages. Governor Cuomo, also on that day, on Tuesday, announced that he was going to use his executive authority to create a $15 minimum wage for all state workers. In New York City, that means that all state workers will be making $15 by the end of 2018. And throughout the rest of the state, they will climb up to that point by 2021. And these jobs will be people from lifeguards to office assistants to custodial assistants, and they estimate that it's going to affect about 10,000 state workers, or 6.5% of the state's permanent and seasonal workforce. So I think out of this concern, Governor Cuomo said the reason he was doing this is he said if you work full-time, you should have a decent lifestyle for you and your family. The state's current wage was failing from that promise, and so therefore he said that was why they were increasing the wages.
How much is it going to cost?
I don't have the estimate of what the cost is, Monsignor. I said, but I mean, it will be substantial. I know one of the things, the National Restaurant Association, in response to some of these marches, were saying a $15 wage would force employers to replace workers with technology such as touch screens and ordering tablets to raise prices.
But that's happening already.
Some of it is, yeah. But I think that they're saying it's going to wind up.
I just came back from a trip in the airport, and it took me a hard time to figure out how I could buy a cup of coffee in one of the food courts, because all they had were tablets. And so, like, you couldn't go up to somebody and say, could I have a cup of coffee? You had to figure out, you order it through a tablet, and then it got delivered to you.
Wow, that is strange.
Yeah, it is. It is strange. So,
did
anyway.
A person deliver it to you? Or a tablet?
No, not a tablet didn't deliver it to me. I think I had to go up to, I ordered it, mm-hmm. and then I kind of picked it up out of off the counter.
Okay, so you even had to pick it up yourself. It wasn't even delivered.
That didn't bother me. The part that I wasn't going to sit down and eat it. I mean, I've done that.
Right.
But you got a tablet on the console as you're waiting in the waiting area of the thing. And that made sense to me. You know, you did that. It was kind of good. And then somebody brought it to you. But this, I just wanted to walk in and get a cup of coffee, and I couldn't figure out how to do it. It took me longer to figure it out than to drink the cup of coffee.
Exactly.
But anyway, I hope that cup was good.
Yeah, it was. It was fine. It was fine. Let's take a break.
Sounds good.
When we come back, we'll speak about Thomas Merton with our guest, who is Paul Pearson, who is the director and archivist of the Thomas Merton Center at Bellarmine University in Louisville, Kentucky. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us when we come back on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Sirius XM, the Catholic channel. And we speak with those people who try to make our world more just and make it more compassionate. Some of them do it. Some of them write about it. And some of them think about it. And this week we have people who pretty much write about it. They think about it and they help other people to understand better. So we're going to be speaking now with Paul Pearson, who is the director and archivist of the Thomas Merton Center at Bellarmine University in Louisville, Kentucky. Paul, thank you so much for joining us on Just Love.
Yes, good afternoon, Monsignor Sullivan. It's a pleasure to be with you this afternoon.
Well, thank you for taking the time to be with us. So let's give our listeners a little bit of a understanding of who they're listening to on their own. Give us a little bit, just the kind of the snapshot version of a little bit your biography and how you came to get involved with Thomas Merton.
Okay, I've been the director of the Merton Center here at Bellarmine now for 15 years, but as you can probably spot by the accent, I'm not from this part of the world. I moved here to do this.
No, are you from that part of the world where we kind of won our independence from?
That's correct.
Good, yeah. Good, good. Okay, so we ex-colonials have a great deal of respect for your part of the world.
Thank you. So I moved here from England to do this job. And I was introduced to Thomas Merton when I was at high school in England, probably about 15 years old. And once a term, a local priest would talk to the boys. And this particular talk, he spoke about Thomas Merton's autobiography. And this was in the late 1970s, I guess. And I was just fascinated by the story. There was very little in print in England at that time, and it was long before the days of Amazon. So I bought the first book I could find, which was The Monastic Journey, which is a book about the hermit life and monasticism. So not a book I would recommend to a teenager. But there was something in it that just captured my interest. And from then on, I really just continued reading Thomas Merton. At university, I studied theology and then eventually did my doctoral work on Merton and then moved into library science. And it was in the course of doing that work that I was then recruited to come and head the Thomas Merton Center here at Bellarmine University.
So let me ask you, were you surprised when Pope Francis mentioned Thomas Merton before Congress?
I'd had a tiny little heads up that there was going to be some mention, but I didn't realize the context or how he would hold him up there with those other figures.
Now, you got that heads up when the Pope called you a couple weeks before or when you had coffee with him. How'd you get the heads up?
When he asked me to write the part about Merton.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, that's good.
Just kidding. I think there was a press embargo on the speech, and I think somebody had just dropped a little hint out there to one or two Merton people that be sure to listen to this.
Okay. So why do you think he did it?
Well, I think Merton really is one of the outstanding spiritual writers and thinkers of the last century, and often, you know, he gets overlooked in this country in many ways. Bit of a syndrome of the prophet not being respected in his own country, I guess. But around the world, you know, people are reading and listening to him. And he certainly had an impact on many pontiffs over the years. Certainly both St. John the 23rd and Pope Paul the 6th, both were in contact with Merton. And both of them sent gifts to him as tokens of affection, tokens of appreciation for the work that he was doing. And many thought that Merton's writings on war and peace were influential in John the 23rd's document, Parchment Terrace. And I imagine that Francis could well have been reading Merton across his life. A lot of Merton over the years has been translated into Spanish. And certainly I was taught by Jesuits in England, and many of them would say that they found their vocations through reading Thomas Merton.
That's very interesting. And just for our listeners, probably know this. One of the reasons I am a little bit familiar with Merton and the interest in Merton is because the parish that I have that I lived in for about 14 years was Corpus Christi Parish in Morningside Heights in New York City, and that's the parish right around Columbia University where Thomas Merton was conditionally baptized when he kind of decided to become a Catholic. And so I have a familiarity with that. And Paul, I think you know Father Raymond Rafferty.
I do, yeah.
And he became, when he became pastor there, a very, very strong, proponent and somebody who studied Merton and really shared his appreciation of Merton with the people in the parish and so many others. So a little bit of my disclaimer that I have had a little bit of that kind of tangential connection with Merton. One of the things that when we talked with our previous guest, Paul, we talked with Robert Ellsberg about Dorothy Day, another person mentioned there. And one of the things that it struck me about both Merton and Dorothy Day is not unique to them, but certainly both of them underwent a conversion of some sort in, from a life that maybe on the surface wouldn't have appeared to be very connected with spirituality to one that was. What was the events or the events that were part of Merton's conversion?
Yes, he really didn't have any religious upbringing. His father was a New Zealander. His mother was from the States. And they really weren't practicing Christians. And so his first real introduction to Christianity, I guess, would have been at school in England. And in his autobiography, he doesn't give a very positive picture of that experience. And then he would win a scholarship to Cambridge. And his time at Cambridge, he says himself, it was a year of riotous living, that he was getting drunk, listening to jazz, running up debts. It was rumored he fathered an illegitimate child there. And he also failed his exams and lost his scholarship. And so...
Now I'm told, you know better than me, that some of that got censored out of a seven-story mountain?
That's what's been said. You read the seven-story mountain and you really wonder what was so awful about the time at Cambridge because he doesn't really tell us there. But I think it was probably censored out by Merton himself. You get the impression from, I certainly remember it from Robert Giroux, who was his editor for The Seven Story Mountain, that, Giroux cut some material from the book, but Merton himself had cut a lot of things. And I think in his early days as a monk at Gethsemane, I think probably looking back at what he was doing in those days, he was probably just wanting to censor it himself. But then it leaves this kind of gap that he says how awful he was, but he doesn't say what it was.
This is something which has to do with a lot of things, but since it's brought up, it fascinates me. I mean, obviously, he couldn't have gotten away with writing that book now because the editor would have said, so I want to know this because that's going to be the blurb that's on the cover. That's what we're going to tweet out. So he wouldn't have gotten away with it today. And I'm not sure we're better today or we're worse today. Information is great, but maybe we don't need everything all the time. That's just my little kind of ruminating myself about that.
Yes, yeah. No, that's certainly very, very true. And, I think, Giroux was a very good editor. And, he himself would say that with Merton's autobiography, that it was the right subject at the right time and presented in the right way so that, the way the story was told was one that captured the attention of people at that time.
So what do you think it is about Merton, his writing, etc., that kind of captures, captures a certain segment of kind of Christians today and even non-Christian? What is it about him that captures that?
I think there's different aspects that draw different people. But I think one thing that people across the board seem to be drawn to is that Merton somehow shows them a self that they wish they could be, that they can reach towards. I think a lot of people find that they read Merton's books, and he really speaks very powerfully to them about the great possibility of who they can really be. I remember there was an Episcopal bishop once who said that The Seven Story Mountain was a book that read me as much as I read it. And I think that's the finger of God working through Merton's writings.
So what do you think? So the Pope chooses to use Merton in his speech to Congress and through Congress to the United States of America. What if you could pick two or three themes or two or three ideas from Merton that it's worth us reflecting on as a society or as a church today, what would they be?
Yes, no, I think there's certainly a number that I can identify there. You know, one is certainly his spirituality, that, you know, Merton really opened up the great depths of the Christian spiritual tradition for people in the 20th century, especially before the Vatican Council, in a way that other writers weren't doing, that he wrote in a way that people could clearly understand what he was saying about prayer and contemplation. And I think so many people in our busy lives today are still very much trying to search out for that kind of way of life, how they can incorporate some of that into their life. And with the way we're bombarded by media and technology, you know, if anything, we're more in need of hearing that message than we were when he was writing it in the 50s and 60s.
So, okay, that's one. What does he have anything to say to us about kind of war, peace, social justice?
Oh, most definitely.
Now, and how's it different than the run-of-the-mill kind of standard traditional Catholic social teaching?
Well, firstly, I think, again, Merton was very much ahead of his time, that, you know, initially when he went into the monastery, you get the impression that he's turning his back on the world, but gradually he realizes that he can't do that, and he comes to the realization that he's in the monastery for the world, and he begins to start in the late 50s and into the early 60s addressing many of the issues of the time. Of course, war and peace, nonviolence, the arms race, the Cold War, those kinds of issues. And in America, at the time he was writing this, he was a bit of a lone voice. Remember, there was a Catholic in the White House for the first time, and you know, there was a real sense of loyalty among the Catholic population to the U.S. government, and you know, all schools would have had pictures of John the 23rd up on the wall and John F. Kennedy. And Merton was, you know, from the confines of the enclosure, questioning things to do with war and peace and the arms race. And, you know, I think by the end of the 60s, the climate had changed drastically. You know, you had the religious sisters involved with protests with the Sisters of Selma or the rise of liberation theology. But at the point that Merton began addressing these issues, they weren't really being addressed in that way within the Catholic Church. And then he gradually broadens that to look at other forms of violence as well. And so in the early 60s, he begins writing about racism. And as with his writings on war and peace, the message really is as relevant today as when he wrote it. You know, in some ways, if not more so, we really don't seem to have learnt many of the lessons. And though, you know, a lot of the issues may have changed, some of Merton's key insights are still just as relevant.
And Paul, thank you. Those are two good things that I think our listeners can kind of reflect upon. And Paul, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with us and to sharing you know, your understanding of Merton and how, you know, today that he continues to be somebody who has something to say to us, and we would do well to reflect upon his writings with regard to spirituality, his writings with regard to war and peace. So thanks so much for being with us. Paul Pearson is the director and archivist of the Thomas Merton Center at Bellarmine University. So as we kind of are in Veterans Week, we kind of reflected on some of the issues of war and peace. Both Merton and Dorothy Day give us something to reflect upon. Join us again when we speak about those people trying to make our world better. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love, the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Isn't this it? Or was I over here? I was over here. Oh, I was listening to the wrong one. Well, it doesn't make any difference, right?
Yeah.
Okay. 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 I can hear myself. Okay. I can begin whenever I want.
Yeah.
Okay. Hello, happy Thanksgiving. I wish I could wish you happy Thanksgiving, but there's not much to be thankful about this year. Look at all the war. Look at all that's going on in the world. Everybody's going to stuff themselves with turkey on Thanksgiving. They're not going to like their relatives in any way, and they're going to talk about them when they go home. So why should we say thank you? I mean, this is just ridiculous. I mean, anyway, but if you want to say thank you, you can wish you everybody a happy Thanksgiving, but I know you don't mean it. How's that one?
Was it 30 seconds?
So what do you think? All right.
Oh my god. Wait, I will show that. I'll send that to Adam. Like, how's this? Like, that's giving a heart attack.
In 4 seconds, I'm going to begin. Happy Thanksgiving. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. I'm the host of Just Love. And I just want to wish everybody such a very, very happy Thanksgiving. This is one of my favorite holidays of the year because it's not a lot about gift giving, but it's a lot about community. It's about family. It's about trying to share with each other. And from my point of view at Catholic Charity, so many people try to be more generous. And that brings out the best in us. Happy Thanksgiving. Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, Just Love. Hi, I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. We're drawing near to Christmas. I know we got to celebrate Advent, the time of preparation and hope, but what we're preparing for is Christmas, when Jesus comes among us, when he brings us into solidarity and union with one another. So I want to wish you the best for this season. Peace, joy, love, and happiness. It's really important during the season that we celebrate the spirit of goodness and peace and reconciliation. Merry Christmas to all. Hey, guys and girls, this is Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. We're getting ready for New Year's. And you know what New Year's is? That's the night everybody goes out, gets drunk, and we hope that, you know, they make it home at the night. And we say goodbye to the old year. Pretty bad old year. And everybody says, well, next year is going to be better. But it's never better. It's still as bad as the previous year. So, you know, who knows? So go out, have a good time, watch the ball fall from Times Square, but get home safe, okay? Have a good, happy New Year. So you want me to do a Christmas one too?
You know what? We're gonna use that one. We're gonna stop right now and use that.
Here we go. Happy New Year. We look back on an old year, and you know, if we're honest, we say we're looking forward to a better new year, but there's always good and bad in the old and the new. And so next year there's gonna be good and there's gonna be bad. But the issue is, how do we make it better, even when it's not so good, so that we bring peace, we bring love to those whom we meet every day? So let me wish you a very, very happy New Year, and that you bring the spirit of peace, of love, of fellowship to all those whom you meet during this next year. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. I'm the host of Just Love on the Catholic Channel. Hey, I just want to wish you a very merry, merry Christmas. And I got to tell you what I'm doing this year. I'm drinking Dunkin' Donuts, because those people at Starbucks, they left Jesus out of Christmas. We need Jesus in Christmas, because that's what this is all about. And, you know, but I got to tell you, I really like the presents that I get at Christmas, too. And Jesus has everything he needs, but I like some presents. So, hey, listen, have a real merry Christmas, and hope you have a good time. Merry Christmas.